log in, log on, opt out?
We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry.
Mark Zuckerberg is back on Capitol Hill today. Are lawmakers ready to regulate to protect your data? The EU is already regulating platforms like Facebook. A commissioner from the Federal Trade Commission is here to explain.
It's really grounded in giving individual users more control and rights to their data.
Plus, the unsolved mystery of 221B Baker Street. Who owns Sherlock Holmes' address in London?
This represents London's new role as a mecca for offshore money coming in from countries with serious problems with corruption.
And Paul Ryan says he's retiring as Speaker of the House. We'll get the latest from Capitol Hill. This is the Takeaway Podcast for Wednesday, April 11th, 2018.
What is the Facebook exactly?
It's an online directory that connects people through universities and colleges through their social networks there. You sign on, you make a profile about yourself by answering some questions, entering some information such as your concentration or major at school, contact information about phone numbers, instant messaging screen names, anything you want to tell, interests, what books you like, movies, and most importantly, who your friends are. Just check out people's online identities and see how people portray themselves and just find some interesting information about people.
Find out some interesting information about people. On the Facebook, back in 2004, the year that platform was launched, that was a young, bright-eyed Harvard dropout called Mark Zuckerberg describing his invention to CNBC as a place to connect and, as I mentioned, find out some interesting information about people.
When we first launched, we were hoping for, you know, maybe 400, 500 people. And now we're at 100,000 people, so who knows where we're going next.
Well, we know where Facebook went next. Today, 2 billion active monthly users across the world, 25,000 employees. And if it's the sharing of information, that thing that Mark Zuckerberg touted as a key feature of Facebook a decade and a half ago, it's what landed him before Congress this week as Facebook CEO, dressed not in that trademark hoodie, but in a suit and tie.
Facebook is an idealistic and optimistic company. For most of our existence, we focused on all of the good that connecting people can do.
All of that optimism has run squarely into congressional oversight now. Mark Zuckerberg was forced yet again to apologize for the abusive data from Facebook users. Zuckerberg's testimony was motivated largely by reports that research firm Cambridge Analytica improperly gained access to data from 87 million Facebook users, used that information, and shared it with an unknown list of third parties.
But it's clear now that we didn't do enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm as well. And that goes for fake news, for false interference in elections and hate speech, as well as developers and data privacy. We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry. I started Facebook, I run it, and I'm responsible for what happens here.
I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.
We face a number of important issues. All right, Senator, so a number of things I think are important here. Good and important question here. There are a number of important points. Most important, Senator, the most important thing is a really important one. Extremely important. Senator, I think that that's an important principle. Senator, those are all important questions. Yes, Senator. I think that that's very important. Important conversation. Important points in there. Senator, this is actually a very important question here.
Mark Zuckerberg got some good advice on how to face lawmakers in congressional testimony. Always validate their questions. They really like that. Mark Zuckerberg is before the House Energy and Commerce Committee today, where he faces more important questions about how and when information was shared and to what effect. Edmund Lee has been following all of it. He's managing editor for Recode, and he joins me now in the studio. Edmund, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Well, I want to start from yesterday. Look, this was a long session of hearings, Mark Zuckerberg in front of senators. But I want to start with this exchange between Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, and Mark Zuckerberg. Listen.
Would you be comfortable sharing with us the name of the hotel you stayed in last night?
No.
If you've messaged anybody this week, would you share with us the names of the people you've messaged?
Senator, no, I would probably not choose to do that publicly here.
I think that may be what this is all about. Your right to privacy, the limits of your right to privacy, and how much you give away in modern America in the name of, quote, connecting people around the world.
Edmund, Dick Durbin is an old prosecutor himself, and he has a way of getting to the point. He says that's what this is all about, your right to privacy. Do you agree?
Yeah. No, he did a great job of illustrating in very concrete terms what this means, what's at stake. At the same time, I think what Mark Zuckerberg had sort of stressed throughout the testimony, 5+ hours, is that you have control. You decide what you want to share. So in other words, if you didn't want to say where you stayed in the hotel, you didn't have to. But if you happen to mention it, it's fair game. I think that's where there's the fine line of, well, if I'm saying where I stayed, does that mean that, you know, advertisers can see that and try to sell me ads for other places I could stay? I think that's where it starts to get a little wonky.
Look, we all know this is about privacy, Edmund, but before users can make good decisions about privacy, there has to be transparency, right? I mean, one of the fundamental questions here is whether all of the many hundreds of millions of us who use Facebook know the rules of the road when we click the privacy settings and we know what can be done with our data, whether it's opt-in or opt-out. Here's Senator Richard Blumenthal, another old prosecutor, by the way. He's a Democrat from Connecticut, and he took a swing at this transparency question.
Would you agree that users should be able to access all of their information?
Senator, yes, of course.
All of the information that you collect as a result of purchases from data brokers, as well as tracking them?
Senator, we have already a download your information tool that allows people to see and to take out all of the information that Facebook, that they've put into Facebook or that Facebook knows about them. So yes, I agree with that. We already have that.
Now, Edmund, we're going to talk about that download tool in just a minute, but what about transparency? There's a consent decree over Facebook already that goes back, I think, to 2011. I might have that wrong.
That's right.
Look, when we log on to Facebook, is it clear to regular old users like me about what Facebook can do with my data and what they can't?
Almost certainly, it's not clear for pretty much all of us. No one's reading these terms of service. They're thousands of words long, written in a style that it's hard to penetrate. So, yeah, it's a fair point that a lot of the senators made yesterday. Terms of service are not clear, which basically means, you know, it's not transparent. You're obfuscating. I mean, it's a legal protection for Facebook, of course, but in plain language, what I do with this, what can happen with what you say on Facebook, most users are sure to not know about that. And I think that's, again, what they were trying to get at.
Now, Mark Zuckerberg says Facebook has a download tool where you can download all of the data that Facebook has available on you. We've been asking listeners all week to do that. I've done it. So if people have their data in front of them now, what are they looking at?
They're looking at sort of their whole log, their whole history of what they've done on Facebook, photos they've uploaded, messages they've exchanged with people, events that they've agreed to go to, but also most curiously, the advertisers that have been targeting them, you know, whether it was something that they interacted with or something that they liked, that signal, that data point then, you know, sort of went out to advertisers that might be interested and said, hey, you should look at this. And I think that for a lot of people, probably the most interesting part of that download. And it's for me, my own personal log, it's largely unremarkable. I'm not the most active on Facebook, but certainly posted photos and spoken to friends and family like most other people. Yeah, it's a history of what I've done and what I've looked at. There are definitely some interesting things, and I'm sure a lot of people had something similar in terms of the advertisers that have been targeting me. And it was interesting just to see that some had nothing to do with what I'm interested in, like a ski vacation, for example. I've certainly gone skiing in the past, but maybe a handful of times. It's not something I do regularly. And I think a lot of sort of anecdotally, a lot of other people I've spoken with had similar reactions. I had no idea that this advertiser thought I'd be interested in them. I don't think that's harmful so much as it's just a failure of their algorithm. And, you know, it's a curiosity more than anything else.
Well, let's talk about that list of advertisers and what people will find in this data when they download it. I'm not terribly active on Facebook either. I think I use it maybe in the same way that you do, Edmund. But I downloaded my data and the photos are easy to follow. The messages are too. But I found the rest of it kind of jumbled and a little bit confusing, especially that list of advertisers. It was a little hard to discern how many there were, who they were, and exactly what they knew about me.
Specifically also what action that you took, what was it that you either said or liked or whatever it might have been that led that, you know, to that signal for that advertiser. And I think that the lack of transparency around that is certainly an issue. You know, I think ultimately Facebook wants that to be transparent so that they can get the algorithm better.
Now, what about games, Edmund? A lot of attention has been drawn to games and gaming apps on Facebook. I'll confess, I use Facebook primarily these days to play online Scrabble. It's a bit of an obsession of mine, and it is through Facebook. I got a little bit concerned when all of this broke that my Scrabble habit was exposing me to data miners or people I didn't want to have my information. What about games in general?
Games, in a lot of ways, are sort of the foundation of the activity on Facebook. If you go way back when, games are still an essential part. But it's the right question to ask because of what happened with Cambridge Analytica. It's entirely possible games have harvested some of your data, and it's fine for them to do, given the terms of service that, you know, developer agreement that Facebook has with them. The hard part is going to be determining, well, have these game developers shared that data with someone else? And that's what happened with Cambridge Analytica. We're talking about downloading your data and what you saw, which kind of advertisers you've reacted with. That download won't tell you if a third party had somehow sold your data off or used it for a different purpose. So again, there's not enough information there. There's not enough transparency there. Facebook is addressing that. Of course, they acknowledge that. But yes, it's definitely player beware if you're playing games, for sure.
Now, Mark Zuckerberg did a lot of acknowledging and a lot of addressing in these hearings yesterday. There were a lot of responses that sort of went to the idea that we fixed that, Senator, or we're fixing that. Do we have a good sense of exactly how many of these problems Facebook has actually fixed? I mean, I point you back to the consent decree in 2011, where transparency was supposed to be out front for Facebook and data sharing was supposed to be out front as well. And a lot of analysts have said they failed there.
Yeah, I think in terms of how they execute against that consent decree, I think that's a fair assessment. I think even Mark Zuckerberg himself has acknowledged to some degree that, yes, there are things that we failed on, that we should have done better, that we should have informed users. There's still a big gap between what the consent decree requires and how Facebook acts on it, how they view it. In other words, there's enough gray area between these two that, you know, Facebook could reasonably argue, well, the Cambridge Analytica incident didn't actually violate the consent decree, and here's why. And that's something that Mark Zuckerberg stressed yesterday. He's clearly been, informed and briefed by his counselors, by his attorneys on that fact. So they clearly have some kind of position to take there. My point being that if Congress is going to regulate more deeply, any future consent decrees, any future deals would have to be that much more sophisticated and nuanced so that there's less of a gray area in terms of how they're interpreted or how they're acted upon.
Well, let's talk about one of the other giant issues hanging over all of this. Whenever somebody like Mark Zuckerberg goes in front of an institution like Congress, will Congress turn around and decide that this internet juggernaut needs to be regulated a lot more than it's regulated right now? Here's Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina.
What would you tell people in South Carolina that, given all the things we've just discovered here, it's a good idea for us to rely upon you to regulate your own business practices?
Well, Senator, my position is not that there should be no regulation. Okay. I think the internet is increasingly
important. Do you embrace
important.
Regulation?
I think the real question, as the internet becomes more important in people's lives, is what is the right regulation, not whether there should
be or
not. But
you as a company, would you work with us in terms of what regulations you think are necessary in your industry?
Absolutely.
Well, Edmund, look, Facebook has an army of lobbyists in Washington now. They're not just a tiny company in Silicon Valley. They got a lot of money. They make a lot of campaign contributions. Is Congress going to have the courage and the technical expertise to really seriously regulate these problems of data sharing and what users know about Facebook?
I think there certainly isn't a political will. I think, to your second point, technical expertise, I think that is going to be the big question mark in terms of, you know, it requires a real sophisticated understanding of how these systems work that would require either good regulation or whether it's legislation even in the future. And, you know, it needs to sort of stand the test of time as well. It can't be something that, you know, you enshrine today that is irrelevant in 6 months or a year. And again, that's going to come down to technical expertise. Of course, Congress has its lawyers, has its experts. Facebook has its lobbyists, its experts, and they're going to haggle over that. So chances are that they're going to have a good discussion around it. But again, it's something that even Facebook itself isn't always aware of in terms of how their system works or how things will react. So much of it is driven by software and algorithms. They don't even always know the outcome.
And maybe, Edmund, the next time we have you on, we have to bring along an expert in the history of monopolies and maybe the power of lobbying in Washington, D.C. Because like I said, Facebook is a giant now. And if people want to call it a monopoly or crack down with regulations, they're going to fight back ultimately.
Definitely. As Mark Zuckerberg said, they're willing to engage in some kind of regulation, but it will only go so far. If it comes to the point where it really hurts their business, they're going to draw a red line and say, well, not beyond that point.
Edmund Lee, managing editor for Recode. Thanks a lot, Edmund.
Anytime.
While U.S. lawmakers continue to reckon with Facebook's power on Capitol Hill, EU lawmakers already have plans to change data collection and data usage. It's the result of a new data protection law called the General Data Protection Regulation, or the GDPR, and it goes into effect in the EU next month. It requires companies like Facebook to only collect and store the minimum amount of user data needed for a specific stated service. It does a whole lot more, too, and it's got American lawmakers like Washington State Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell questioning Mark Zuckerberg here and wondering if the U.S. could pass something similar here at home.
Do you believe the European regulations should be applied here in the U.S.?
Senator, I think everyone in the world deserves good privacy protection. And regardless of whether we implement the exact same regulation, I would guess that it would be somewhat different because we have somewhat different sensibilities in the U.S. as do other countries. We're committed to rolling out the controls and the affirmative consent and the special controls around sensitive types of technology like face recognition that are required in GDPR. We're doing that around the world.
Well, for more on the comparison between the European Union and American data privacy protection laws, we go now to Terrell McSweeney, who's been a commissioner on the Federal Trade Commission since 2014, advocating for online consumer protections. Commissioner McSweeney, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Commissioner, I mean, one of the big questions we were just addressing a minute ago was whether American politicians are essentially going to have the courage to regulate Facebook. And in Europe, it seems like they've already mustered that courage.
Well, in Europe, there is a different approach. It's called the General Data Protection Regulation. It comes into effect in May. And they're also considering broader e-privacy legislation. It's a different approach than the U.S. approach in that it's really grounded in giving individual users more control and rights to their data. So it allows for individual users, for example, to have more opportunities to say yes or no when their data is being processed by third parties. It includes rights to be informed about how data is being processed, rights to object to that kind of data processing, data portability, data minimization, privacy by design by default. A lot of these concepts, I'd love to point out, are privacy ideas that the Federal Trade Commission and privacy advocates have been advocating for here in the United States as well for a very long time.
Now, how many of these protections, or even the spirit of these protections, are on the books, either in law or in regulation here in the United States now?
Well, in the United States, we really do rely more on a framework that protects consumers from deception, which means you have to tell consumers and get their consent for data collection and use, especially sensitive categories of data. And what's different about what Europe is proposing is the rights really do begin and end with the user. So it's a framework that gives more rights to individual users than perhaps we have in U.S. law. I mean, I think it's important to say that there are some aspects that Congress should pay attention to when thinking about how to better protect Americans' data control and privacy and security, but it may not be practical to totally copy and cut and paste the GDPR into U.S. law because we have different institutions and different legal frameworks here, and we have things like the First Amendment, which are very important, that need to be valued as well.
So talk a little bit about the user experience when they're confronting questions of their own privacy, I don't know, let's say in France or Germany, in the EU. One of the big questions that came up in hearings yesterday was the idea of opt-in versus opt-out when it's a question of data security. How does that play?
This is a key question. And for a very long time, the Federal Trade Commission, which is my agency in the United States, has advocated for clear consent and opt-in choices for users when their sensitive information is being collected and processed in some way. Sensitive information includes health information, financial information, children's information. It also includes geolocation and content of communications. The idea there is to say, look, there are categories of information that you really need to be giving consumers clear, timely opt-in choices around. What is in the GDPR framework is very similar. It just is a stronger legal requirement.
Well, Commissioner, the FTC offices in Washington are just at the foot of Capitol Hill, not far away at all. So as you've been gazing up Capitol Hill at the House and the Senate, what have you seen over the last year or two about lawmakers' willingness to talk about really regulating Facebook?
Well, I think this is a watershed moment. I am encouraged to see a real conversation happening around the kinds of consumer protections that I think consumers need for our highly connected digital world that we live in. We're finally having a conversation at the congressional level, not just about the tools that an agency like the Federal Trade Commission needs, and I think it needs more authority and more tools to protect consumers, but also things like data portability, giving U.S. consumers the same rights that European consumers will have to control their data, to move their data around, and to really own their data in a way that we currently don't have. I think that's terrific. I also think we need to be having a conversation, and I hope we will continue to have this conversation, about increased transparency and accountability for data brokers. There are tons of third parties that you as an individual don't have a direct relationship with that have vast amounts of information about you and are selling those pieces of data. And I think we need to have more transparency and ability to interact with that information as well. Transparency is also a key piece of the GDPR framework because it really allows individual users to make sure they can access the information and data that are held about them and know who's using it and for what purposes.
Terrell McSweeney, Commissioner on the Federal Trade Commission since 2014. Commissioner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Got a comment for the show? Hit us up on our Facebook page. Tweet us at The Takeaway or leave us a voicemail at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Your ideas and takes are a huge part of who we are. Let us know what you're thinking about. This is The Takeaway.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and there's big news out of Washington, D.C. today. Capitol Hill House Speaker Paul Ryan will not seek re-election in 2018. Paul Ryan's been in Congress for 20 years and has been the Republican House Speaker since John Boehner left in 2015. Chuck Quernbach is news reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee, and he joins me now. Chuck, good to have you.
Hello.
Well, Paul Ryan, famously from Janesville, Wisconsin, from your view there, from Wisconsin, Chuck, a surprise?
A little bit surprising. Ryan had been raised money in Texas this past week and had been saying that he would make a decision for sure soon. But when you're out raising money, you kind of get the impression that he's, A, doing it for other Republican candidates, but also for himself. So, yes, it's a bit of a surprise, but not a total shock.
Now, a lot of people around Capitol Hill aren't surprised that Paul Ryan won't be speaker next year. I think a lot of people expected that. They didn't necessarily expect him to announce quite so soon that he would be leaving Congress. What do you think is the urgency here? Is it the awful 2018 midterms that Republicans think they're confronting here?
Well, there were additional signs in Wisconsin last week that the electorate was leaning a little bit more Democratic. Ryan's district, which stretches from Racine and Kenosha along the Lake Michigan shoreline, then west over to Janesville, has leaned slightly Republican, but some rating services had said the race could be fairly tight this year. So he was ahead, and his opponents, at least the Democratic opponents that were announcing, Randy Bryce, Kathy Myers on the Democratic side, both had raised some money, especially Bryce. So Ryan was at least in for a tougher fight, and the Democrats were at least going to keep Ryan more in the district, I think, if he had decided to run, but obviously he's decided not to.
You know, that's interesting. Randy Bryce, a former iron worker there in Paul Ryan's Wisconsin district. Are you suggesting that 2018 could be so tough for Republicans that Paul Ryan was facing a real fight at home that he could possibly lose?
Well, he was at least facing a prospect of being tied up a lot and having to campaign more than he has the last few times when he's run as U.S. representative. So whether he was going to win or not, I'm not sure, or lose or not, but he was definitely in for a tougher fight. And as I say, the signs in Wisconsin that there was more Democratic folks leaning Democratic. Also elsewhere in the nation, some races that have gone Democratic. So this is going to be a tough spot for the Speaker, that if he lost the majority, the Republicans lost the majority, then Ryan was especially going to be, I think, targeted to move on.
Yeah, so talk about 2018 in a little bit. I know you have a view from Wisconsin there, Chuck, but you watch the Congress closely. There is a long and growing list of senior Republicans, committee chairmen and others, deciding not to run in 2018. Paul Ryan is definitely the most high profile of powerful Republicans who say it's not worth it.
Right. I mean, Ryan's obviously the big factor is President Trump's popularity or lack of it in some cases. Ryan had gotten along with Trump to a certain degree, but had dismissed some of Trump's comments and non-political doings. So the relationship, I don't think, was close, but Ryan was still going to get potentially snagged into any anti-Trump vote, and certainly Republicans around the U.S. fear that.
Paul Ryan of Janesville, Wisconsin, Speaker of the House, says he will not seek re-election in 2018, obviously stepping down as Speaker. Watch for the fight, the succession fight, which will be on between people like Steve Scalise from Louisiana. Will that person be Speaker in 2018 or Minority Leader? Chuck Hornbach, news reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Chuck, thanks so much.
Thank you.
B Baker Street, London. As the residence of genius private detective Sherlock Holmes, it's one of the most famous fictional addresses in the world. But it's also a real building in London with a mystery all its own. No one really knows who owns it. Well, Sherlock Holmes isn't around to solve the case for obvious temporal and fictional reasons, but real-life geopolitics reporter for Quartz, Max de Haldevang, took on the case.
The UK has made a big deal of bringing transparency to its ownership of property in recent years and its ownership of companies.
Max started his investigation with a registry that lists the owners of every company registered in the UK.
Now, you go on to the holding company that this Baker Street property is owned through, and it says there's no person of significant control. How can that be? Officially, that means that the only possibility, assuming the paperwork has all been done correctly, it's illegal to falsify that. That means that there are more than five owners. No one can own more than 20% of it.
The game was afoot.
So we looked at that and said, okay, so who is the real owner? And we went on this sort of long voyage that goes through an Austrian murder investigation, a Swiss shell company, a 2 million euro yacht in the British Virgin Islands named Nomad, and finally ended up in Kazakhstan with the help of the Panama Papers.
Well, the characters in this expanding mystery would eventually grow to include longtime president of Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev, and further reveal the tangled web of London's shadowy real estate dealings. But first, Max de Haldevang went back to where it all started at 221B Baker Street, London.
It's a very well-heeled area around there. You're just next to Regent's Park, which is a lovely big green space. And you walk along just out from the tube station, you come across this row of Georgian houses, a very pretty row. And next to them is a massive Art Deco building, quite handsome Art Deco building. Now, that is actually where the original 221B Baker Street, the home of Sherlock Holmes, is. Obviously, that around the world is known as an address for, you know, Britain's most famous gentleman crime fighter, this great scourge against criminals. But we've put out an investigation last week that reveals that actually this represents no longer Britain's great sort of upstanding legal past, but rather it's now London's new role as a mecca for global, international, offshore money coming into the UK capital from countries with serious problems with corruption.
And how certain are you now that the family of Nursultan Nazarbayev actually own a significant chunk of 221 Baker Street and the surrounding block?
what we can say is that we know that that Nazarbayev's grandson, Nurali Aliyev, who used to be deputy mayor of Kazakhstan's capital, that he owned this yacht via the same British Virgin Islands company. So he owned a yacht via this British Virgin Islands company. That same company was ultimately the same owner of the Baker Street properties. So there's an extremely close tie between those two. And there's an extremely close tie between all the officials that he got to do paperwork for these things. So he had the same nominee director appear on the companies that own the yacht and the companies that own, there was the same nominee director for the companies that own the yacht and the companies that own the building and for separate companies that this grandson has been involved with. So there are lots and lots of links. Do we have a piece of paper showing this? No, we don't. But mainly this is really a question of how much corporate secrecy there is in the offshore world. You know, we've got, even with this big trove of files from the Panama paper, from big legal investigations, we can't say definitively because there are all these things his lawyers creates layer upon layer upon layer that only law enforcement with subpoenas can get to the bottom of. And even that takes months and months.
Now, I mean, so many stories about this new identity for London, the home for international, sometimes shady cash to be parked, maybe for Russian oligarchs or their cronies. In this case, why would the Nazarbayevs want to park $100 million in property in London?
It's a little bit more than that. It's $180 million. I mean, there are a few reasons, really. I mean, these are the president's offspring, his grandson and possibly his daughter who are tied to this property. If it is them who own it, their reasons for doing so are, there are a few. I mean, one, you want to get the capital out of the country. Because if there is a change in leadership, you want to make sure you have a lot of money that you can flee to that they're unable to grab in a jurisdiction that has, you know, safe rule of law rather than in Kazakhstan, where if someone else took over and all the courts are pliant, they could easily seize that property. And number two is this is an office building, an apartment building. All those things are rented out. It's different from a lot of properties we see from owned by oligarchs. They're rented out and they'll be raking in a ton of money in rent in this very prestigious address.
I mean, this is a bit of fun because it's the Sherlock Holmes address, of course, but there's some very serious issues embedded in this story, of course, Max. People must be sounding the alarms in London, not only that so many hundreds of millions and billions in sometimes shady foreign cash are essentially being hidden in London properties, but that it's so very hard to track. It's so very hard to know who's protecting their money in London real estate.
Right, exactly. I mean, the figure that an NGO called Transparency International has come up with is £4.2 billion worth of British property or London property they estimate is owned by people with suspicious wealth. And you know, there are 10, I think it's 86,000 properties in the UK where we have no idea who the owners are. Now, this becomes a serious issue when you look at things like the poisoning of Sergei Skripal, the Russian-British agent, allegedly by the Kremlin. So there's been a lot of news about this idea of seizing oligarchs' houses who are close to the Kremlin, because you wonder how they fund an operation like that. You know, presumably there's a lot of expenses in getting this poison over to the UK, getting agents in with, you know, false passport, who knows. How do they have money there locally into the UK when it's very difficult to launder back into the country? Could it be from properties owned by people close to the Kremlin that they're renting out and getting rent into a British bank account that doesn't have the same international money laundering controls, perhaps, and from there are able to pay over to the assassins?
Alex, what about British pride here? I mean, this isn't just any old office building that might be owned in any metropolis. This is 221 Baker Street, the home of Sherlock Holmes. I mean, this is worse than finding out that 4 Privet Drive, Harry Potter's house, is owned by some Russian oligarch.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's literally as bad as it could be. And you're right. It just goes to show that all these, and you know, it's not just Britain. I mean, Britain is really one of the worst, but the US is just as culpable for a lot of these issues. You know, we go around preaching transparency and anti-corruption, and we go teaching other countries, developing countries, how they should have their systems and institutions. And yet we are letting in all their most corrupt money or allegedly corrupt money into our shores that we profit from. And they point at that and go, hey, what's going on here? You know, we do all these things to sort of tie up corruption at home, but when it's looted from our budget, you're the ones who receive it.
Well, Max, it's certain that you got a lot further than Scotland Yard would have gotten if this were a Holmes novel, that's for sure, before the detective himself stepped in. So this real-life detective work is something to be proud of. So congratulations, Max de Haldeving, geopolitics reporter for Quartz. Thanks, Max.
Thanks very much. Pleasure.
And that's all for us today. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. What happens when the IRS comes looking for you?
This call is officially a final notice from IRS, Internal Revenue Services. The reason of this call is to inform you that IRS is filing lawsuit against you.
That's not the IRS. What you need to know about tax scams this season. That's next time on the Takeaway Podcast.